Hello, friends. I want to invite you to come join us for our first ever Theology in the Raw Exiles in Babylon Conference, March 31st to April 2nd. At this conference, we are going to be challenged to think like exiles about race, sexuality, gender, critical race theory, hell, transgender identities, climate change, creation, care, American politics, and what it means to love your Democratic and Republican neighbor as yourself. Different views will be presented. Everyone will be challenged to think critically, compassionately, and Christianly through all kinds of different topics. We've got loads of awesome speakers that are going to be there. Thabiti Anuboale, Chris Date, Derwin Gray, Ellie Bonilla, Jackie Hill Perry, Edwin Wickham, John Tyson, Tony Scarcello, Sandy Richter, Kimi Katiti, Heather Scriba, Street Hymns, and many others will be joining us for the first ever Theology in the Raw Conference. All the information is in the show notes, or you can just go to pressandsprinkle.com to register. And I would recommend registering sooner than later. Space is limited. You can come and join us in person in Boise, or you can stream it online. Again, pressandsprinkle.com for all the info. Hello, friends. Welcome back to another episode of Theology in the Raw. My guest on the show today is Seda Collier, and I know basically nothing about Seda other than she is a trans woman who read my book Embodied and sent me a really awesome, kind email. And we had a couple email exchanges, and I said, hey, would you like to have a conversation? Seda said, sure. I said, would you like me to record that conversation and throw it on my podcast? And she said, sure, why not? So I am going to call Seda right now. I know little to nothing about Seda other than just a couple email exchanges. And so this is going to be super raw in the sense that I have no clue how this conversation is going to go. But hey, we're just human beings getting to know each other. So please welcome to the show, Seda Collier. I'm going to call her right now, and you could just listen in on our conversation, I guess. Here we go.
Hello.
Hello. How are you?
I'm doing really well. Let's see.
You are.
Yeah.
Hey. I had the wrong. You must have had an older Skype account because it was a picture of you, and I kept messaging and it wasn't the right one. And then I went to the email and plugged in your email address and it worked out. So.
Yeah. I probably did.
It's early out there. Thanks for waking up to be on the podcast and hang out and have a conversation.
My pleasure.
Yeah. Seda, is that how, am I pronouncing Seda. It right?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep, that's right.
Okay, cool. Yep. Well, thank you so much for your kind email. I mean, that I do get a lot, and I as you probably noticed, I don't have my personal email anywhere on the website or anywhere really. And some emails never get to me. I just can't, you know, but then this one, one of my assistants forwarded it to me, and he's like, I think you might want to read this one. I'm like, oh my word. I was just so encouraged by it. And like, I don't know. It just seems so authentic and humble and wise. And I was like, man, I really want to get to know you. So yeah.
Wow. Thank you for that. Can you say that again?
Just to start, I mean, you probably know more about me than I do about you. So as much as you would love to share, I would just love to hear your story. And I'm sure that's could be a hour long conversation, but yeah.
Yeah. Just let me check in real quick. Is the sound okay from my perspective?
The sound looks great. Yeah. The only thing, okay. If you want to you're lower on the screen than I am. So mate, I can't really go lower because my chair. There you go. That's perfect right there. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Sounds great though.
Good. So I'm a trans woman. I transitioned in 2007, basically.
Okay.
I don't know if you want to go back to the beginning from, you know, childhood.
Why don't we start there? And I'm sure I'll have questions about kind of your upbringing and all that. But yeah, let's start with 2007 to now, and then we'll go from there.
Yeah. So in 2006, really, I kind of hit a wall. I'd been struggling with some really serious gender dysphoria since 2003, and got therapy. I had 2 years of therapy for it. Took care of all the background stuff, childhood issues and substance abuse issues and stuff like that. And finally it was like, okay, I'm not getting any more out of therapy. So I stopped getting, you know, stopped mm-hmm. therapy. And I was married, had two kids. My first son was born in 2000, second in 2003, early 2003. So okay. Young kids. Yeah. And really, I guess kind of have to go to that moment in 2003 where I just realized that the stuff that I'd been dealing with since as long as I could remember, since you know, before entering school, was because I was a woman. And I'd been trying to be a man for all this time, you know, joined the Marine Corps and commercial fishing and all this stuff and really doing my best to do that. Then got married, then, you know, had kids, and all of a sudden it's like, comes down, it's like, oh my God, you know? And, it was this moment of really, almost euphoria for about 2 seconds, followed by this, oh my God, I have a wife, I have kids. Oh, yeah. These people depend on me. And how am I going to deal with this? You know, and that's where the whole thing, right. where I started going into the therapy, getting therapy. So, you know, 3 years of that, started a new business.
Real quick, were you talking with your wife about what was going on, or was all this very much just kind of kept inside? Or
it was so in 2003 when that happened, yeah. I had to talk to her about it.
Okay.
Before then, you know, I'd told her some of these things, you okay. know, like I tried to share with her that I was really messed up, but it wasn't, I wasn't clear on why. I was in denial, basically. And so, you know, she didn't know how to deal with it. I didn't know how to deal with it. It was kind of, you okay. know, we just kind of pushed it into the background and okay. went on. So yeah, so then in 2006, you know, I'm working on my new business and going along, and gradually this the gender dysphoria, this bloating, the depression, mm-hmm. all of this stuff was getting worse and worse. I was getting more and more suicidal, mm-hmm. Reaching the point where my day was basically occupied, or, you know, my internal world was really planning suicide.
Wow.
I was literally, you know, like, okay, you know, how I don't want my kids to have a legacy of their dad committed suicide. So how am I going to set this up so that it's like, it's a for sure I'm dead. And, wow. And nobody thinks it's anything except an accident.
Okay.
Wow. And okay, this is, you know, my family, you know, I was the only, money earner at that point. Yeah. Kristen was working harder than me, but she was taking care of the kids in the yeah. household. You
know? We all know how that goes. Does your wife work? Yeah. Yes. She raises the kids.
Yes.
And,
yes, she does.
Yeah.
She
works. Yeah.
She's not actually earning money from right. outside, but yeah, she's working harder than I am. Yeah. So it's like, okay, how am I going to make sure that I have sufficient health insurance or life insurance that's going to, you know, make it so that, oh, that yeah. she can, you know, get by until she can find a man. Wow. And I just reached in August that year, I just reached the end of my rope, and I told Chris, and something has to change. I could not go on. I had maybe 2 to 6 more months that I could have pulled it off. I don't think I could have lived another 6 months. I think I would have been dead.
Can you, for people, I guess, like me, who don't have a category, like, what is there? Is there anything more concrete you could even give us to help us understand what was so, like, driving you to just constantly think about suicide? Was it like an internal angst? Was there societal, I don't know, shame or pressure, you know, or all the above? Or is it even hard to describe? I don't know.
It's extremely hard to describe. And I've never really seen anything that describes it adequately. Mm-hmm. Because it's like this gender dissonance, this internal conflict. There was Mythbusters guys?
Yeah.
They did a piece on torture one time, and then they were describing like this Chinese water torture thing. And I saw an interview. I can share the link to you sometime. A YouTube interview where one of the guys from that was saying that after they'd done this piece, they got an anonymous email from somebody who said that what they'd found was that if you had a steady drop, it almost became like a meditation, and the person could ignore it. But if they randomized the drops, within 24 hours they had a psychic break.
Wow.
So it's like that. It's like I've heard gender dysphoria described as existential torture.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really good description of it. I like, do you know who Julia Serrano is? Have you heard of
Serrano? Yeah. Whipping Girl.
yeah, exactly. Have you read that?
No, it's on the list. I heard it's an interesting read.
Yeah, actually I recommend it. But it's like this is a really good description that I could have written this. Uh-huh. My gender dissonance only got worse with each passing day. And by the time I made the decision to transition, my gender dissonance had gotten so bad that it completely consumed me. It hurt worse than any pain, physical or emotional, that I had ever experienced. What changed during that 20-some year period was not my desire to be female, but rather my ability to cope with my own gender dissonance. Mm. When I made the decision to transition, I honestly had no idea what it would be like for me to live as female. The only thing I knew for sure was that pretending to be male was slowly killing me. Wow. You know, I can relate. That's like, I could have written that. So this is what I'm going through at this point. And that's when Kristen was like, okay, you know, let's get going on this. Let's go ahead and take the step. So I got a new therapist, Reed Vanderberg, in Portland. So I live in Eugene. So it was a 90-mile trip up to Portland to see him. But he specialized in gender dysphoria and transgender issues. And so within a few meetings with him, he was like, yeah, you know, here's your letter to get hormones.
Okay.
I started hormone therapy in 2007, and then in August of 2007 is when I changed my name, changed the marker on my ID, and started living 24/7 as a woman. I've been living as a woman ever since.
Can you? I'm so super curious now. I mean, both the suicidality and gender dissonance, as you put it. How's that been since you transitioned?
It got better.
Okay.
Like as soon as I committed to transitioning, things started getting better, turning around. And one of the things that really I think that really made a difference for me. There's so many things. There's so many different ways to talk about this. But one of the things that really made a difference was for me was that all of a sudden I was living in integrity. You know, I'd spent all this time living in this kind of like not telling the truth about who I was, trying to build up. So like, you know, demonstrate to the world and really validate to myself that I'm a man. You know, I mean, I grew up in 1960s in rural Wyoming, right, on a cattle ranch.
Really? Wow.
And yeah. And so the model of manhood that I saw was very, the word macho comes to mind, yeah. But I don't really like that. I don't think that's a good one, but it was a very, very definite, model of a certain kind of, you know, masculinity where a man is like, you know, has the responsibilities and
right.
tough and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And so that's kind of the model I was working off of. Mm-hmm. And I knew from my earliest, you know, days that there was something wrong with me.
Okay.
I didn't really know what it was. I mean, I could see that I was male, I, you know, had a penis and all this mm-hmm. kind of stuff. And that was reflected back by everyone around me. Mm-hmm. Including in the ways that I was ridiculed for doing things like throwing like a girl or running like a girl, these kinds of things.
So you did naturally act and resonate more with what we would call femininity, more feminine, culturally defined feminine things and interests from an early age? Or
apparently so. I mean, I think I would have been, had I been female, I think I would have been a tomboy.
Okay.
I very much was into doing things like, you know, riding my steer.
sounds pretty masculine.
Yeah, you know, and you know, fishing and stuff like that, and climbing trees. You know, so I was really into that kind of stuff. I also enjoy, you know, playing with my sister, with her dolls sometimes, Barbies. And when she got into sewing for 4-H, I was really jealous that she could do that and I couldn't, you know, mm-hmm. but on the other hand, I really enjoyed doing woodworking.
Okay. Yeah.
So, you know, and when it came time for branding, you know, I didn't want to be back there helping with the cooking. I wanted to be there, you know, wrestling the calves. And I wasn't the only girl who wanted to do that, right?
Yeah. I mean, those Wyoming women, man. I live in Idaho, so yeah, a lot.
So, where was I?
Yeah, we're kind of the dysphoria and suicide ideation, you said that lessened. Did it not completely go away? And were there waves, or were there certain things that kind of triggered it? Or long term, did it come back? Or
yeah, so what happened was as I transitioned, taking the hormones and electrolysis to get rid of my beard and stuff, and it felt a lot more congruent.
Okay.
You know, and a lot more honest. So I was relating with people and you know, it's not always easy because people weren't always reflecting that back to me. I mean, I looked pretty awful and I had some, you know, experiences that were not that pleasant. But it was better. And what kind of got worse than over the next, see, so 2012, so over the next 5 years was the physical part. You know, so there were things like because of the hormones, I was growing breasts and that started, oh, wow, that feels normal.
Yeah.
But I still had my genitals, and I could feel that. And in April of 2012, I started having these anxiety attacks that were associated with the physical sensation. And it was really intense. I had to take Xanax to control it. And like for the, you know, from April 2012 until July 2013, when I had surgery, I took Xanax everywhere I went.
Wow.
You know, I had my little bottle of Xanax, because once these attacks started coming, I could not control them. I would literally, you know, end up curled up in a corner in a fetal position. Wow. Just, you know, I don't even know how to describe it.
And that was more specifically rated to like body specific dysphoria, for lack of better terms. Is that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
And then July 23rd, 2013, I had surgery, and like the day after, you know, it's really uncomfortable. You know, I'm all hyped up on morphine. I guess it's not hyped up. It's more like I'm all like draggy. Like, woo. And I'm like, I don't need the Xanax anymore. And I threw it out, and I knew I would never need it again. And wow. I've never needed it again.
Wow.
And
why is that? Because you were on morphine now, or?
No. I was on morphine for, you know, a day or two. And then, you know, I had some pain pills and stuff for a while until I recovered. And it's a long recovery period. I mean, that's a major surgery.
Oh, so it's after the surgery that the anxiety went away. Okay.
Yeah.
Got it.
Exactly. Okay. Like the day after, it's like, wow. It was like a hard break. I mean, for at least 5 years after that, after surgery, I was like consciously just grateful for that surgery.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I'm still grateful, but now it's become more normal. You know, it's like, yeah, almost like, oh, I could take it for granted kind of thing.
Yeah.
But, but yeah, it's like, you know, I think one of the things that Christians a lot of times don't understand is that, yes, gender dysphoria is a killer, you know?
Yeah.
It's not a direct killer, but if you're trying to deal with this thing that you can't do intense,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
it's not sustainable.
I've got a few friends, friends that have
necessarily that way.
What's that?
Oh. Not that it's necessarily that way, right?
Right.
I mean, it exists on a spectrum, on a wide spectrum.
Exactly, yeah.
From really mild to really severe. It's like autism spectrum disorder, you know?
Right.
You have some that's really mild, and you have some that's really severe, where you're not even verbal.
And certain
for me,
things...
It was bad.
Certain things can trigger it too, right? If it does, if it is coming in a way... I mean, I'm thinking of two people in particular, my friends, who it's just... It's a pretty steady high kind of, it's kind of always there. Other people who it is more waves, and there are certain life events that, or even comments or certain things that might trigger it. You know, one of my friends, biological female, goes by they, them, you know, they were having, you know, a bunch of women over for like a women's Bible study into their house. And they said the anxiety was just through the roof. She's like, and they just imagined like all these, you know, women in pink dresses coming in with their teacups. And it wasn't that, you know, but
right,
it was,
right.
You know, just the thought of being in an environment, a closed environment, with just oozing with femininity was just like, I mean, yeah, dysphoria just skyrocketed, you know? And yeah, it's just such a, it's, is, from what I've, I mean, read and heard, it's just, it is so mysterious almost. Like, I mean, the top scholars, it's like we're at the beginning stages almost still trying to understand it. And like all the therapy in the world for some people doesn't seem to do anything. And I get that. I mean, I'm curious about that. Like, on the therapeutic side, was there anything there that was helpful, things that were related to the dysphoria, or was it just this kind of separate category that's just like, this is not caused by anything specific. It's just there. I don't know why it's there. I don't know where it came from. Or does therapy, did therapy help in any way? Or
So I'd had several different therapists and reasons for therapy. So that first initial 2 year period of therapy, I actually had two therapists. The first one was like, I got into some of the darker stuff that I was dealing with, and she was like, I can't deal with this, I'm going to refer you to somebody else. So I went to the other one, and that was really helpful. I worked through a lot of stuff. And I think it's actually really important, and I'm really grateful for that therapy, because I dealt with all kinds of stuff from my childhood and you know, substance abuse and really dark fantasies and all kinds of stuff. I worked through all that and pretty much resolved it, right? Mm-hmm. But it didn't do anything to the gender dysphoria.
Got it. Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
So then when I started having these anxiety attacks, I got another therapist who did work with transgender issues to try to help me deal with the anxiety attacks. It was a complete waste of time.
Okay.
It wasn't about anything psychological so much. I mean, it was obviously the anxiety, it's psychological, but it wasn't triggered by any kind of psychological or trauma event. It was triggered by my actual body, right? So there was nothing I could do. It was physical. It wasn't mental. And then before and after surgery, I got a therapy during that period of time to help me manage that transition, because that's a huge transition. And it was just kind of like a support. It was helpful, but it didn't really, you know, change anything,
yeah,
I would say.
Yeah. So I'm curious about your wife then and your family. I mean, gosh, that was 15 minutes ago. And I'm like, okay, so lots happened since we left off in what, 2006 or whatever. So give us a overview of how was your family impacted by this, and how did they receive it?
Well, it's for Kristen, it was a big shock. It was really hard. It was because it wasn't just me transitioning. It was also her, right?
Oh.
She was forced to look at her own identity, at what it means for her to be a woman, you know, and to really call this into question. And I was really fortunate that about the time that this all started happening, she started learning nonviolent communication. And so we used a lot of that, and we would have like, you know, just for a while, like in 2006, 2007, probably, it was like this kind of daily thing, you know, get up and, you know, how you doing today? Well, I'm okay. How are you? And yeah, do you think we'll be, you know, should we get divorced? It's like, no, not yet. I don't know, you know, and dealing with this, and it wasn't like just all easy. It was really hard. There were a lot of times of like just, you know, crying on each other's shoulders and stuff like that. But we stayed connected through it. You know, it's like we were both committed to our kids, to doing the best we could for them. We're both committed to each other in the sense that, you know, we loved each other and you know, even though we didn't know what would happen next and whether we would end up together or whether we would split apart. In the moment, life was better together. And so we kept, we stayed with it. And over time, really, I think did a lot of healing. Kristen, you know, 2009, we moved into different bedrooms.
Okay.
Stopped sleeping together. Determined basically we're both heterosexuals. And we've been together, you know, so Chris and I have been together through all that time.
So you're still together.
We're still together.
Okay.
And we are on the very cusp of being empty nesters, right? So our youngest is in the process of moving out. He has a house.
Yeah. How did your kids handle it all?
Well, when it started, Sam was about 3 years old.
Okay.
And Trin was about six. So when we sat him down after Christmas 2006 to explain this, we waited till after Christmas so we could have, you know, the holidays with family without having this upheaval, and started explaining this to them. For Sam, it was like, oh, okay, you know, whatever. And Trin was like, you know, he's like, okay, he was really into science, so he explained. It's kind of like clownfish, you know, clownfish that will naturally change sex sometimes. So he's like, okay, you got that. And then he kind of got this sad look on his face, and he's like, does this mean you won't wrestle with me anymore? It's like, no, we'll still do that. I'll still wrestle with you. And he's like, oh, okay. And it's been fine, you know.
Okay.
Actually, Trin is my oldest is visiting with us. He's just ended one job in California. He's moving on to his next thing.
Okay.
But if, I mean, I'd like to, you know, invite you to ask him, you know, how it was.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
But and he'd be willing to talk with you, I think. But the next year after I transitioned, probably must have been the summer of 2008, I overheard him talking with his, he was playing with the neighbor from across the street. And we had a whole kid pack in our neighborhood. It was a great neighborhood for raising kids. And so he's talking with his neighbor across the street, and his friend said, don't you miss having a dad? And it was like, he responded right away, no, I like her much better as a woman.
Wow.
That's a direct quote.
Wow.
You know, wow. I was like, huh, good.
Now, I read online, first of all, thank you for being so just honest and open with your story. I mean, gosh, a lot of these things are personal details that you're sharing freely. And I think it's helpful for us to hear stories, but I don't have a right to your story, you know, so thank you for inviting me into it. I'm just so sorry you had to battle that level of dysphoria and suicidality. I just can't imagine what that was like. So
I think it's important to note also that like you mentioned in your book a number of times, quoting from Mark Yarhouse, if you know one transgender person, you know one transgender person. So this is my story, right? All I'm relating is my own. And when we get into opinions and stuff, which I'm sure we will, you know, there's a YouTube video out called The Danger of a Single Story. It's by a Nigerian woman. I forget her name. But I highly recommend that. And, you know, one of the things that I think is really important in this conversation is to remember that what I'm saying is my story.
Right.
you know, right. what I'm saying applies to me. It doesn't necessarily apply to other transgender people. Yeah.
That's super that's helpful. And I feel like in this day and age, people do use individual stories or even more anecdotal kind of things to make a more broader point. And that's just so problematic, especially in this conversation. I mean, I've taken me a lot while to learn just that point. Like every single story, there's overlap in some stories, obviously, but everybody has so many unique features and it's hard to, take one story and weaponize it or capitalize on it, you know? I have so many questions. We haven't even talked about faith. I mean, you're a Christian, right? I mean, raised in a church or are you in the church or are you still in the church? What's your faith journey look like?
Well, I was raised in Christian Science Church. And we lived out in the, out in the country, you know, 20 miles from town. So, at least 25 miles from church, was not a regular churchgoer. I didn't really, I kind of took that in as sort of, I adopted it as a belief system, but I didn't really internalize it at all. It was not like I didn't really have any understanding or commitment to it. So when I was 19, I joined the Marine Corps. I was really consciously, my intent was that I would, you know, this is how you become a man. This is like, I can become a man through this. I was always looking for those things from outside that would make me feel that inside, you know, try to validate this. And so I joined the Marine Corps to become a man. And ended up, made a really good friend at this, specialized school on a Navy base in Florida. And my friend was really into drugs. He was, you know, PCP, Quaaludes, you know, downers and barbiturates, he was like pretty radical into them. He got me into them. And so I got kicked out of that school, because it was, you know, should have gotten a top secret clearance. And when they found out, you know, I got in trouble for doing drugs, and went to Camp Lejeune. And in Camp Lejeune, I had no friends. I knew nobody. I was like so isolated. It was a really hard time. And one time I was going through Jacksonville and ran across these folks from Grace Baptist Church in Jacksonville.
Okay.
And ended up having a conversation. Ended up September 1980, going down the Romans Road to salvation, accepting Jesus as my personal Savior.
Okay.
And I didn't really take it in, right? I mean, it was like, okay, this is a thing. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't like it didn't make any super big difference in my life.
Okay.
It was like, okay, I believe this. I'm convinced I'm going in this direction, but it didn't actually change anything, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And then my friend got kicked out of that same school down in Florida and came up to a different part of Camp Lejeune. So I met with him, and one day he gave me a couple of hits of acid. Mm-hmm. And part of a gram of cocaine. And so on this one day I was by myself and I took the acid. Mm-hmm. And when I started tripping, I snorted all the cocaine. And all of a sudden I heard this voice in my head as I'm starting, you know, starting to hallucinate and see this, you know, kind of the vision. I don't know. Have you ever done LSD?
No, no. smoke some weed. Okay, that's so, you
so you don't really have an idea how the your vision kind of starts floating and things start really shifting and you know, it's pretty weird. And I suddenly had this voice in my head that said, "This is better than God." And I immediately was like, "What? No, this is wrong." And I rejected it just with everything I had. And I'm not going to say friends, the people I'd been talking with at Grace Baptist had given me a copy of the NIV Bible. It was my first NIV Bible. And I just went and I grabbed that and opened it at random, opened it to the story of Jacob's ladder and Jacob wrestling with the angel. And so I'm trying to read this, and the words are literally floating on the page, so it's really hard to read them. But I'm just like, you know, in such a moment of rejection of that voice and calling out to God, and had this really, really reaching with my whole heart for God. And all of a sudden, in just one moment to the next, I could see clearly. I was completely sober, and I just had this sense of this amazing love and peace. It was like I encountered Jesus in an amazing, powerful, and profound way that was completely undeniable.
So you met God. What you're trying to tell me is you met God on an acid trip where you also took cocaine, and that's where he met you. Listeners of Theology in the Raw, we are not prescribing this as a way to encounter God.
I did not prescribe this, but this is really important, Preston, because it was in my rejection of that I found God.
That is wild.
It wasn't in doing it. It was in rejecting it.
Wow.
That is really important point.
So many layers there. That's so what year is that? That you said that this is back in the early 80s?
That was 1980.
Oh gosh. Okay. 40 years ago. 41.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
So it was a matter of me crying out. And you know, and being saved.
Yeah.
It was like that moment where David realizes, you know, Nathan comes in and confronts David about what he did with Bathsheba and Uriah. And he's like, "Oh my God," you know. It was that moment of profound repentance.
Wow. So since then,
instant healing of that trip. It was like one moment I was tripping, the next moment I was completely sober.
That's wild. I don't think I've heard a story quite like that before. That's wild. So your faith journey since then?
So that really established for sure an undeniable belief in and faith in God. From that moment on, I've never been able to deny the reality of a very present, real God. But over time, I kept running into these contradictions and an inability to resolve the things that were going on with me through my faith. So I went back and forth in different number of different ways. Ended up by the time I went back to Christian Science for a while, then rejected it, tried different churches. By the time I transitioned, I was basically unreligious.
Okay.
About probably 2008, I'd reached the point where I was like, you know, I rejected religion.
Yeah.
I didn't reject God because I knew that God was real. But I couldn't, religion wasn't practical to me. It wasn't doing anything. And I think a lot of it was just in the fact that a big part of Christianity is integrity, right? Mm-hmm. It's telling the truth, not only telling the truth to others, but telling the truth to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And I was lying. I was lying to myself. I was lying to others. I was telling everybody, you know, I'm a man, you know, mm-hmm. I'm presenting this way. I'm like, you know, really pushing this narrative about who I am that isn't true. And I think because of that, I wasn't able to really stay faithful.
Hmm.
So when 2006 came around, when I started transition, we had some really dear Christian friends. And it's like we had this group of like a play group with my kids. And one of our, well, how does this work with my faith journey? I think we'll leave that because that isn't important for that aspect. But around 2009, I started having a sense. By that time, I'd transitioned, and you know, I was like living as a woman full time, and I started really missing that spiritual life, and started reaching out and reading the Bible. I was working downtown Eugene, about a block away from the Christian Science Reading Room, and I started going to the Christian Science Reading Room every day and having these conversations at lunchtime, having these conversations with the librarian there, really nice guy named Richard, and you know, had some really deep conversations about God and transgenderism and stuff. Mm-hmm. And started going back and started going to the Christian Science Church again. And then in 2012, I started getting these anxiety attacks. And at the time, I was really, really unsure. I didn't know what was right from a spiritual perspective. So in September, I'm trying to deal with all the Xanax and controlling these anxiety attacks. And in September of 2012, I decided, okay, I need to get an answer from God. I need to resolve this. And I decided that I would read only the Bible,
mm-hmm.
and I would pray and you know, basically go on a fast, not an eating fast, but spend all of my free time. The only thing I would do in my free time would be to pray and study the Bible and that's it, until I had an answer from God. And you know, at the same time trying to work, you know, keep up with help Kristen with the household and the kids and work. You know, we were still a single earner family at that point. Mm-hmm. I forget exactly when Kristen started working outside the house again. And so I did that for 3 months, September, October, November, and about halfway through December, I was sitting right here in this very chair and praying so hard. And I just, you know, it was like a point where I was like, total surrender. It was like, I don't know what to do. You know, I don't know whether it's the right thing to get surgery or not, whether it's the right thing to live as a woman or whether I should transition back and live as a man. Mm-hmm. And I was like, just tell me what to do, God. Tell me what's right. Whatever it is, I'll do it. I'll try, you know, even if it's like going back. And mm-hmm. and it was probably the most intense prayer I'd ever had, certainly the most intense, you know, since that trip back in 1980. And I hear this voice, and it said, "You are my beloved daughter in whom I'm well pleased." Wow. Small D daughter. And once again, I just feel this sense of love and peace. And I that wasn't an answer, right? That didn't answer my question of what should I do. But within a couple weeks, I was like, that's all I'm going to get. I need to figure out what I'm going to do. And what I find really interesting about that is that the consequence of that moment completely broke my faith in Christian Science.
Okay.
Within, I don't know, not very long after that, I was like, mm-hmm. "No, it's not for me."
Yeah. Okay.
And it really, I think, set me on a path to, I think, what you would call Orthodox Christianity.
Okay.
Probably the, you know, like I think of the way it's described in Mere Christianity, the C.S. Lewis mm-hmm. book.
Okay. Are you part of a church or denomination now, or?
I attend First Baptist Church here in Eugene.
Okay. Yeah.
And really like it. I don't identify as Baptist.
Okay.
Yeah. I identify as Christian. I've grown to be really wary about sex, about, you know, different doctrines.
Yeah.
Maybe that's not the right word.
Yeah.
Just. Is it following Jesus? I'm okay.
Yeah.
But you know, have you read Francis Chan's book Until Unity?
I have not read it yet. I'm ashamed to say that because we go pretty far back, Francis, and I have not read his latest book. So you got me red-handed. My audience is going to crack up.
I recommend it. It's really good, you awesome. Know. But he talks about it there, and like what is important. And your podcast with Brian Zand not too long ago.
Yeah.
You know, it talks about what's the foundation of mm-hmm. our faith. The foundation of our faith is Jesus.
Right.
Right. It's not really the Bible.
Yeah.
I mean, the Bible talks about Jesus. It describes Jesus, yeah. but it's not the foundation. The foundation is Jesus. Mm-hmm. And so my religion is my relationship with Jesus.
Following Jesus. You know? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. I am curious. Sorry. Go ahead.
I don't really care whether you call that Baptist
right.
or you know, non-denominational or Presbyterian or whatever.
Right.
It doesn't matter.
How are you received at church? I mean, that's First Baptist Church, and you show up, and I mean, is that – I'm really – I would love to call their pastors right now and say, hey, tell me about Seda.
Absolutely. Talk to Ben Cross. yeah, he's a really, really good pastor. I really like Pastor Ben.
Hey, friends. Hope you're enjoying the conversation so far. And if you are enjoying this conversation and others like it, would you consider supporting the Theology in the Raw ministry by going to patreon.com/theologyintheraw? You can support the show for as little as $5 a month and get access to lots of different kinds of premium content like monthly Patreon-only podcasts and blogs and Q&A sessions. Again, you can go to patreon.com/theologyintheraw, or all the info is in the show notes.
I really like Pastor Ben. In your email, you wanted me to talk about how Christians have affected me.
Yeah.
So I'll give you that story, which is actually at this point, the faith story intertwines.
Okay.
So when we first transitioned, Kristen took the job of coming out to our, to a lot of our friends and neighbors. She took it on herself in order to put a buffer between me and a direct response. Very sweet of her to do that. And so we had this really dear Christian friends. Their kids were the same age as our kids. And you know, so there's like this multi-layer friendship, our family, their family.
Mm-hmm.
And so she came out to these folks and they were like, bad.
Mm.
We can't handle this. This is wrong.
Mm.
And we can no longer interact with you. We don't want to talk with you.
Wow.
Our kids can't interact with your kids anymore. So not only did I lose them as a friend, and it was really, really painful. I grieved that, the loss of that relationship for years. But also, my kids lost friends.
Mm.
From it. And I felt that was really, really unfair.
Yeah.
Blame them. I was very angry for a long time. But also it made us really cautious. And I think Kristen kind of held it in for a while after that, where she could have, really benefited from more support, from our network of friends. But we had another Christian friend, and it was like probably like a year and a half, 2 years later when Kristen was finally like, okay, I'm going to come out to this friend. We can't keep hiding this. So, we're going to have to. And was really, really scared that we were going to lose another dear friend. And so she went for a walk with Tam one day. And as she's talking about this, Tam's like, but Kristen, God still loves her.
Hmm.
But Kristen, she's still a child of God.
Wow.
And coming back with this stuff, and at the end of it, I met with Tam and, gave her a hug. So turns out 10 years later, it's about 2018 or so, Tam invites me to a women's Bible study at First Baptist. And I've been going to First Baptist ever since.
Yeah, to a women's Bible study. What year was that?
I think it was 2018.
Might have been
2017.
I would love, this is fascinating. Cause I mean, I get most of my emails are from like pastors and, they're like, hey, what do I do? I have a trans woman that showed up, or a trans man. Or I got an email from a church in Texas saying, we just found out one of our main Bible study leaders used to be a woman or something, whatever it was. And like, we didn't even know, like, what do we do now? Like, all these. So I get it from that direction. And I guess it should be encouraging. Like, they're wrestling with what they believe and how to include people in a set of beliefs and being consistent with that. But man, they're agree or disagree with where they land. I think the heart motivation behind about 90% of the emails I get from pastors are just, they're golden. They're like, we want to be Jesus to everybody that walks through our doors. What does that look like? I'm like, we can talk through it. And I don't know if I have all the magic answers, but so it's fascinating to talk to somebody on the other side now, the one who they're like, oh my gosh, this is awesome, but it's, what do we do? is there, I mean, so I just have a bunch of questions. Is there, are there certain level, this is the question I get from pastors, like how deep can they get in the church system? Can they serve? Can they become a leader, an elder, whatever? Like, have you wrestled with that with your ministry team? Like, you could attend a women's Bible study. I mean, could you lead one? Or is that even something you would aspire to do? Or have you even had that conversation? Can you become a member of the church? I mean, these are raw questions, so, and I hope they're not like offensive. But these are just real questions people are asking.
Not offensive at all. And actually, the membership question is really interesting because when I first started going, they had a new paper out that was like, I think it's what would be considered non-affirming.
Okay.
Basically saying that we affirm that, you know, that male and female is as distinct genders and, right, and the transition is not right. But they listened, you know. Which is cool. And so, you know, and I met with several of the pastors and had really, really good conversations. They never, you know, it was like right from day one, I could go attend the women's Bible study. I didn't come out all at once. It was more of a really slow, you know, okay, we're having this conversation and now it kind of comes out. Obviously my friend knew, right?
Right.
And she was there with me. And then the leader knew as well.
Okay.
So it's like I found a place to fit, right? Yeah.
And the other women in the Bible study they didn't have an issue, or I guess you said they
didn't seem to. I mean, you know, they took it in, and right, maybe it's because I was there in front of them and they could, you know, interact with me and see me and stuff. Yeah. But you know what? I couldn't become a member. You know, they wouldn't allow me to be a member.
Okay.
So then it's really interesting because, this last year, I was like thinking about that and went back and wrote to my pastor, actually to the pastoral team, and said, yeah, I want to be a member, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think the lead pastor was on vacation at the time. But there was something was like, and one of the women's ministry pastor was, had some life stuff going on.
Okay.
They couldn't deal with it right now. So okay, like, wait a minute and we'll get back to you in a month or so. And in that period of time, I was looking at this stuff and seeing the way that our culture is shifting, the way that the transgender debate is shifting, and the, you know, the stuff with rapid onset gender dysphoria and stuff like that, and seeing this stuff, and I'm going, man, this is more confused now than it was 10 years ago. And it was pretty confused 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Now it's going off the rails. What does it mean for me to become a member of this church? What is that? I mean, from the church perspective, what is that saying? And I was like, you know what? I don't want to be responsible for the consequences of becoming a member and how that shifts the internal working of the church and how that affects members and how that affects our culture.
That's, I mean, this is so profound, Seda. I have friends who pastor churches, or a friend who pastors a church in Eugene, not at First Baptist, but yeah, he's, you know, I think he said like 1 week, like three of his youth group came out as trans, and the rapid onset stuff. Like there's just a skyrocketing number of teens coming out, and it doesn't, you could say this and probably get away with it. From my vantage point, it doesn't seem like their stories are similar to yours, is how I maybe put it. Maybe they are. Maybe they are, have the same kind of dysphoria you had and suicidality and everything. It just doesn't seem like that. Is that what you're getting on? Like your story does seem to be quite different than many of the teen stories I'm hearing. Is that, I mean, so cautious of my words here. Or how about you? What do you think about rapid onset gender dysphoria? And when you look at the culture, how it's affecting teens with the trans conversation, talk to us about that.
It scares the crap out of me.
Really?
Yeah. You know, and it's really hard. And I don't know that I will be given necessarily any more mercy than you. It might actually be, you know, worse for me to come out with this stuff. But what I used to work for this nonprofit called Transponder. Mm-hmm. It's a really wonderful organization here in Eugene that serves the transgender community. But there was a point at which I kept running into these, you know, I run into things like you can be trans and never have gender dysphoria.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, well, how does that make sense? It's from my perspective,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I can only speak for myself. But it was really, for me, I don't think that transgenderism is a healthy thing. You know, I look at it and I see, you know, biologically we have male and female, you know, I mean, that's, those are biological core categories, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, without that, our species goes extinct, right? I mean, it's foundational.
Mm-hmm.
And you see that in so many ways, not only in culture, but also in biology. And so I see this stuff about we have all these different genders, like demigirl and gray gender and stuff like this. I'm like, wait a minute, we only have two biological categories, male and female.
Mm-hmm.
And gender relates to those, mm-hmm. right? I mean,
yeah.
When I look at it, that's what I see. It's like gender exists in relation to sex. I mean, that's, you know, they are inextricably entwined.
Hmm.
Now, yeah, in sex, you do have things that, you know, the occasional anomaly, like, what is it?
Intersex?
I mean, there's a lot of different intersex right. conditions, you know, like androgen insensitive syndrome, you know, like complete androgen insensitivity yeah. syndrome. You have somebody who is genetically male, but their body develops as a female, mm-hmm. you know, it's like looks like a female body. Well, I don't see anything biologically that would say that's impossible for gender. Hmm. Right. But still gender exists in relation, even if gender is not man or woman, and I'm making a distinction here, right?
Yeah.
Male, female, man, woman. Even if it's not man, woman, it still exists in relationship to man, woman.
Hmm.
That's
a good way of putting it. So going back to the teen thing, yeah, when you say it scares you to death, like, can you unpack that a little bit and help us? You know, I think you have more insight to helping us understand how can we get our arms around that aspect of the conversation? Because some people say it doesn't. Some people say if you even mention, I mean, whenever I mentioned rapid onset, I don't say I get hate mail, but people are like, oh, junk science, you just think it's all. I'm like, no, I didn't say to deny that. To me, the evidence is just so overwhelming that at least in some cases, maybe a lot of specifically younger people, that there is something in the social environment that is playing some role in influencing trans umbrella identities, you know, demi girl, non-binary, and so on. I'm not saying it's all that at all. Your story is very different. And in most older trans people I talk to, like yourself, I feel like they're the ones that are the most concerned because they do have the lived experience. It's like, this isn't the same thing, you know? But my main heart is I want to help. I don't want to get, because some people just throw up their arms and get angry, right? What does demi girl mean anyway? What are all, they're just on social media, you know? And that's not my motivation at all. My motivation is I think there is a population of troubled teens, oftentimes wrestling with lots of other mental health issues. They're growing up in a society that's just, I can't imagine being a teenager today with a smartphone in my pocket at 13. Like I can't imagine managing that. And so it is out of concern and compassion that I'm like, man, I want to help us understand, you know, this aspect of the conversation, but it is deeply concerning. Anyway, I want to know your thoughts.
I think the problem is that you can't know, right? There is no way that I know of to say this person is genuinely trans and this person is not.
Right.
Right. But I think that what we need to start, what we as trans, what I would like to see is my transgender community start to bring in the experience of detransitioners, such as Walt Heyer and Laura Perry. I don't know. Are you familiar with? I think you're familiar with Walt Heyer.
No, of them.
Sex Change Regret.
Yeah, yeah.
And Laura Perry has a website called Transgender Transformed. And I think it's really important because these people have important stories, right? They had really tragic things happen to them because they were misdiagnosed as trans. Mm. And then took transition treatments, right? So in Ryan Anderson's book, When Harry Became Sally, he talks about Walt Heyer and quotes Walt Heyer as having a dissociative identity disorder, which is different from gender dysphoria. It's not the same thing, right? Mm. So because of that dissociative identity disorder, Walt ended up transitioning and lived as a trans woman for 8 years and then transitioned back. So in Laura's case, she had a lot of, I mean, if you, what I get from reading her testimony on her website and in conversation is that she had a lot of internalized misogyny associated with childhood trauma and her relationship with her mom. And because of that, rejected her femininity and determined that she was trans and transitioned. She talks at one point about when she went to get a letter for hormones. Mm-hmm. Her therapist after three meetings was like, you have some real mommy issues. And she was like, no, you know, I'm not here for that. I'm here to get a letter. And so she got, she transitioned and lived quite a period of time as a man. But when I read her testimony, what I see now, again, this is my perception in reading it, you know,
yeah.
Is that right? Who knows? But what I get from reading her testimony is that she transitioned because of this internalized misogyny, and then started to experience gender dysphoria, which is what I would expect of someone who is not trans.
Yeah.
Because her description of what ended up happening after her transition was sounded like to me gender dysphoria.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Wow. So then she transitioned back. Now, the thing, so on the one hand, I would like to see our transgender community actually deal with this in a more meaningful way. Like, yeah, detransition is an issue. Detransition is a problem. We have people who are doing permanent change to their bodies and then coming back and saying, you know, that was a really bad idea.
Hmm.
Right. On the flip side, I would really like to see Christians, including Christians like Laura Perry and Walt Heyer, say, yeah, I was never trans.
Okay.
Hmm. Because what they're saying is, I was transgender and I got healed from that or cured from that through my interactions with Jesus. Mm-hmm. But I read their testimony, it's like, that wasn't transgender. Right. You were never transgender. Your experience was very, very, very different from mine. Mm-hmm. You experienced gender dysphoria after transition, not before transition.
Wow.
Before that, you had other issues. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, you know, in some of this, the stuff that you relate about rapid onset gender dysphoria, you're talking about that the people who have this, a lot of the young people who have this have other issues going on. Right. I think those issues need to be addressed.
Right, right. I mean, that's aside from the trans conversation, if you're dealing with past trauma, ADHD, or on the spectrum or whatever, or you're just like, you go through COVID and you're lonely and isolated and just life is just, you know, like, we need to deal with all these things. And the thought that taking hormones is going to kind of solve all that, I think that's almost across the board what I'm seeing, especially from people who are detransitioning in their like early 20s, who might fit the kind of rapid onset profile. Almost unanimously, they're like, I had all these other issues. I didn't want to deal with them. Nobody else really forced me to deal with them. And I thought hormones was the answer. And, you know, 2 years later, they're like, I still have, I now have more issues, you know,
I
still haven't dealt with.
So I think it's really, you know, important to deal with those. And I'm super, super grateful that I got all that therapy before I transitioned, right? Because I dealt with that stuff.
Right.
That was really important for me. Lost my train of thought. I was going to say something, but
I'm curious if would you make a cat? Do you think teenagers should ever transition, or do you think it is that rare exception of somebody who might? Basically, I mean, you were a teenager at one point, you know, are you really cautious with teenagers transitioning, or would you say categorically they should wait until they're, you know, I don't know if there's a certain age or.
Yeah, I think that when you're talking about transgenderism, going categorically with anything is right. Dangerous.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, I look at when I was a teenager, you know, I remember dancing around and when I was alone at home wearing a skirt, thinking, why would anyone ever want to, you know, wear anything else? You know, and so there's, you know, when I was a teenager, had I known, I didn't even know that transgender existed.
Okay.
Right. So it wasn't a category. It wasn't a possibility in my mind. Had I known, had I, you know, lived now, I think it's very likely that, you know, I would have transitioned at that point. Mm-hmm. I don't know that, obviously. I mean, it's different. Had I been tracked on some kind of psychological profile, I probably would have fit into one of that 80% of kids or thereabouts that resolve their gender dysphoria as they go into adulthood, right? I would have been considered that. And that's one of the things that makes me cautious about that is, yeah, I would have at that point, because I rejected so completely my femininity and you know, my identity as being anything other than a man, in going on and trying so hard to become a man. But then that came back to bite me in my 40s, right?
Okay.
Because all of a sudden I couldn't deal with the gender dysphoria anymore. Well, it wasn't all of a sudden, it was more like gradually.
But it
accumulated to that point. So you know, on the one hand, it seems that statistic, and I think it's really dangerous to get hung up on statistics.
Okay. Yeah.
Because statistics are not humans, right?
Right.
And you can prove a lot of different things with them, right, including using the same statistics to prove opposite things.
Yeah.
But in, you know, assuming the accuracy of that statistic, that 80% or so of kids with gender dysphoria are going to naturally resolve it, seems really dangerous to start giving, you know, puberty blockers to those people.
Yeah. Yeah.
At the same time, you see people like Jazz Jennings or Nicole Maines, and people, you know, kids who are from the earliest age, insistent, persistent, consistently presenting as the sex opposite to what their, you know, biological sex is. And boy, it seems like it was a good idea for them to transition.
Hmm.
I have a friend, a trans man, who talks about, you know, when he was a kid, and at one point in grade school, you know, they line up to go in from recess, boys and girls, and he lines up with the boys, and he's passing as a boy, and he's like right there with the boys. Mm-hmm. And for him, it was tremendously traumatic to be forced to wear a dress and to, you know, go back to school, because it's parents found out about it and forced him to do that. His dad was actually a pastor. And the last time I talked with him, he's like, you know, I mean, he sincerely believes that God hates him.
Wow.
Yeah. On a personal level, you know, and to me, you know, God is love.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, that's a problem. So again, it's like, okay, how do you navigate this? And I don't know.
Hmm. It's tough. It's a complicated conversation. I'm curious, and I love that you're just so chill and honest and don't get offended or whatever. I'm curious. I'm going to ask a question and acknowledge that it's very, you know, it's a controversial concept, but the concept of autogenophilia, does your story resonate with that at all? I'm assuming, you know, okay.
Yeah.
What do you think about that? Like, is that that category? Do you think it's, do you know people that do experience? I've got a few friends that would, when they read about it like that, yep, I absolutely struggle with that. And I know it's very, Julia Serrano, not a huge fan. and yet when I read her story, when I read some of her stuff, and then I read kind of stories of other people who would experience this, it's, I'm like, well, it does sound like that, but like, I'm not going to say like, no, it is you, you know, if they're saying it's not, but, I don't know. I'm just trying to get my arms around the concept. And so it doesn't, that doesn't resonate with you at all.
Yeah. It doesn't really resonate with me at all.
Okay.
What can I say about it? You know,
yeah.
It's, I would say that, that doesn't apply to me.
Okay.
But I can't really say, I mean, you know, one of the things I keep coming back to is 1 Samuel 16:7, I think it is, you know, Saul is you know, the Jesse's kids are mm-hmm. coming forth, and you know, one of them, he knows that one of them is going to be the next king, right? He sees this one, he's like tall and mm-hmm. tough, and you know, all this kind of stuff, and it's like, nope, not him, nope, not him,
God looks at the heart one.
You know, man looks at the outward right. appearance, but God looks at the heart. So I keep in mind when I'm looking at other people, whether it's autogynephilia or rapid onset gender dysphoria or whatever, I'm looking at the outward appearance.
Yeah.
Right. All I can see is the outward appearance. I can make guesses based on the outward appearance.
Yeah.
But I could be wrong.
Yeah.
Because God looks at the heart.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, when I look at how a lot of Christians, especially Orthodox Christians, look at me, I think, yeah, you're looking at the outward appearance, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're not looking at the heart. Mm. You're not seeing me as a whole person. You know, and it's like there's this image of Caitlyn Jenner superimposed in front of me, and that's all you need to know, right? But that's not me, you know?
Right. Yeah.
And you really don't know Caitlyn Jenner either.
Well, we're so prone more than ever in the last couple of years, right? To take our favorite news outlet, political pundit, dare I even say podcaster, as kind of the lens through which you view all these issues, you know, and then they become just issues, debate points, political things rather than individual stories, you know. So I guess we're all prone to that, and especially once, you know, COVID hits, we're all isolated, so our whole world is just kind of online and everybody's grabbing for our attention with clickbait titles to get us riled up. It's just it's disaster, and the trans conversation is just right smack dab in the middle of that. And yeah, that's I'm really touched that you've had a good experience at First Baptist. Really, that's
me too.
It sounds like you're okay with, we might not line up on everything, we might have disagreement, but you're humanized, you're listened to. It sounds like they're trying to understand your story and you as a person, and you know, that's
yeah. And it's really amazing, you know. And and I think one of the things that Christians might miss is how incredibly precious it is to be able to stand up and sing praises to Jesus in a corporate setting with all these other people, when for a long time you've been felt like it was not safe, that you didn't have a place at church, that you needed to hold your faith tight inside, because for me, part of my faith journey has been, you know, from like when experiencing that rejection when I first transitioned, up until I started really reaching out to Christian churches, it was like I didn't go to church because I was scared. I didn't feel welcome. So I would hold my faith inside, and I didn't share my faith with my trans community because really they've been wounded, you know? I mean, when I was facilitating support groups for Transponder, I would hear again and again these stories of, yeah, I came out to my dad, it didn't go well, you know? He lit into me and we're not talking now. You know, other family members and losing church, losing faith community came out to my pastor, and he's like, you know, we don't want your kind around here. So it's like almost every person I'm talking with has a first person story of rejection by a Christian. And so it's not like, you know, you come out, yeah, I love Jesus. it's not the kind of place where that's really going to come, you know, really going to land very well. And so, you know, I was really, really tentative about talking about that. And you know, when I kind of introduced it, for the most part, it's like, mm-hmm. kind of fell flat, not mm-hmm. in the sense of, you know, like you're bad, but in the sense of really not interested. Yeah, that's your stuff, you know, fine.
Yeah.
But, you know, don't put that stuff on me.
Yeah.
Wow. You know, and then you go to a Christian community and it's like, yeah, you know, it's like this, I'm the one community, you know, that I belong to inherently. And it's like coming out as a Christian is can be really fraught, you know? And on the other hand, I go to the other community that I'm really, really belong to. And it's like coming out as trans, it's really fraught, you know? Oh,
that's so, there's a conservative, commentator I listen to, Dave Rubin, who used to be very progressive and liberal. He's a gay man, married to a man, not a religious person, although he's getting more in touch with his Jewish roots recently. But he said coming out as conservative was way more scary than coming out as gay. He's honestly way too conservative for my taste. I listen to him, he's entertaining, he gives me another perspective, whatever. But he's way too political for my whatever. But yeah, I just thought that was, he's like, oh yeah, I was in a community where, like, yeah, to admit that I think I'm leaning more to the right now. People were like, they can't handle that, you know, in his context, at least. Yeah. And I've got several, I mean, many friends who would be LGBTQ and yet more theologically conservative. And they often tell me, you know, I feel like I'm not Christian enough for the church and not gay enough for the gay community. So I just always feel like I'm on the fence somewhere, you know? Yeah. And that's just so sad. Like, especially when they say, I don't feel, here they are, you know, many of them are pursuing celibacy because they don't think it's right to engage in a same-sex relationship. And to me, that's like, that sounds like the epitome of faithfulness. You are picking up a very, very heavy cross and denying a serious aspect of yourself, and you're not Christian enough. Like, people are making you feel like you're not Christian enough. Then I'm definitely out. Like, what? And yet, why do I get a free pass? I can waltz in any church and with all my junk, and it's like, no, that's fine. You know, that's just that's a problem.
And that's that. Actually, that's an observation that I can make. Right? Is that, before I transitioned, as you know, with all my substance abuse issues and you know, sin out the wazoo, I had no problem going to any church and I'm just fine. It's like, okay, now I transition and I'm living a life that you know, outside of transition is so much more in alignment with everything in scripture. But now it's like that single story, right? That single aspect is like my whole journey, my whole personality, everything about me is judged on that single story, right? Mm-hmm. Oh, you're trans, you know, you're like, you know, well, we know about Caitlyn Jenner. What else do we need to know? You know?
Oh, Caitlyn. Caitlyn's running for governor today, I think. Is that today? Is the recall today? I mean, I don't think.
Recalls today, but you know, but you know, Caitlin is who Caitlin is, and you know, but I, you know, I wish that, you know, every time, almost every Christian book about transgenderism talks about Caitlin Jenner. You know, she's featured in a pretty major way. Most of them also talk about detransitioners. Okay. Nobody talks about Lynn Conway, right? Nobody talks about Cass Averill. Nobody talks about Aidan Dowling. Nobody talks about Jennifer Lethem. Nobody talks about Laura Jane Grace. So nobody talks about Kristen Beck. You know, it's like,
can you unpack that for people that don't know who those names are? What do you?
Okay.
Yeah. What are you getting at?
I'm going to have to go to work pretty soon. So I don't know how much unpacking I can do right now.
I do too. So we'll round it out with this. So,
but, Kristen Beck was a Navy SEAL who, wrote a book called Warrior Princess. Read the book.
Warrior Princess.
Let's see. Laura Jane Grace is the lead singer for Against Me, a punk band. She's, you know, transitioned. She wrote a book called Tranny. Jan Morris is another one, wrote a book called Conundrum. Almost never hear about her. Jennifer Lethem is a jazz musician, who, you know, I don't know when she transitioned, but she's a trans woman.
I guess my question is, the common feature is these are all people who transition, they're happy post-transition, they're living a life as a different gender.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. Like Cass Averill is the founder and president of Transponder. Aidan Dowling, he was the first trans man featured on the cover of Men's magazine.
Bucket, would you put Buck Angel in that category too? Buck Angel?
I don't know Buck Angel.
Oh, Buck Angel. Trans woman, was the first trans woman adult performer, porn star. Not trans. I'm so sorry. Trans man. And very outspoken. Buck was on, I forget what else he does. He kind of does a lot of different stuff. Yeah, look him up, Buck Angel. You would, so it sounds like Buck would fit very much in the category of people you're identifying.
Yeah. Right. Lynn Conway, worked on a lot of the architecture of the PC. She worked for, she wrote a book that was used for years in teaching computer science.
Okay.
Or programming. She was actually in DARPA, the Department of Defense.
Okay.
Team that helped create the internet.
Wow.
Yeah, she's like big stuff.
Yeah. I've heard of her. No, I've heard of her. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very, very well off, right? I mean, very, very successful person, right? Yeah.
Very successful person.
Yeah.
Although after she transitioned and she was fired, she lost her family. You know, she was basically at the point of destitution when was it Xerox hired her?
Okay.
Well, okay. I think so.
Yeah. Well, I do have to go, and you got to go, Seda. So we have so much more to talk about,
I just want to put in one more plug for Christians to stop using the term transgender ideology.
Okay.
Because that term really has, you know, it's used to say that to make a political statement that my identity is not valid.
Okay.
And that basically that I transitioned because of a philosophical ideology.
Okay.
That has no meaning for me.
Okay.
There is nothing I can connect to there.
Okay.
I transitioned because gender dysphoria was intolerable, because I could not keep going. So regardless of what I believe, whether it's right or wrong, or whether it's an ideology or not, it has no meaning for me.
Mm-hmm.
But when people use the term transgender ideology, what I hear is, I'm not the least bit interested in your story. But what I am interested in is taking political action to limit your ability to function in society. That's what transgender ideology means to me. So if you can do anything to encourage Christians to find a different way to talk about that, you know, gender deconstruction or something like that, and not transgender ideology, I'd appreciate it.
I thank you for that. That's super helpful. I try really hard. I'm always on a journey to avoid any kind of term that's just sweeping, that just is way too broad. So I think I have used the phrase, you know, the ideology that is being promoted by some trans activists is maybe how I might say something. Is that even that doesn't help humanize it. It does identify that there is a thing out there that is a way of thinking that is being kind of forced on everybody. And if you don't believe this, then you're a transphobe or whatever. I'm like, I don't think that's helpful. And I do think, what is the thing that's trickling down and influencing some of the teens we talked about earlier? You know, like that, I do need to name that because I don't think it's helpful. And I think it's hurting people who, in your words, are being misdiagnosed, you know? But I'm totally with you on just that sweeping transgender idea. It's like, I know loads of trans people who don't have the ideology that people are frustrated at. You know, just like,
but yet when you use that, you're putting that on me.
Yeah. Yeah. Right?
You're saying I adhere to this transgender ideology and I don't even know what it is in the first place. And the different definitions I've seen of it, they're not all the same.
Right.
I'm like, well, okay, so it's somebody who wants to support human rights for trans people. Sign me up. Right. I'm here for human rights for all people.
Right.
Right? That's as a Christian. To me, that's one of the things that is my duty, right? I have an obligation to uphold the human rights of all people, whether they're trans or not. So, yeah. Or someone who believes then the essence of a person can be different from their sex. Well, it's like, oh, I don't even know how to relate to that. You know, is that me? I don't know. I can't relate to it. It doesn't really make sense to me in a way that that is practical for me in any sense at all.
Yeah. Well, Seda, thank you so much for the awesome conversation. Thank you for your humility and vulnerability. And it was great getting to know you more.
Yeah. And thank you, Preston, for, you know, for actually wanting to get to know me as a person instead of just putting that image of Caitlyn Jenner in front of my face. Oh, good.
It's been my pleasure. Seriously, this has been loads of fun. So, God bless.
All right. God bless you.